Kadosh. Remember, remember, Adonai Eloheinu.
Welcome to Romamu, an open-hearted Jewish community and house of worship, learning, and spiritual growth. You're listening to Romamu's podcast, where we share words of Torah, insights, and inspiration from Romamu clergy. Thank you for being with us.
I love Israel. I always have loved Israel, and I always will. And being together with a group of Romamu members in Israel last week and the week before was very powerful and transformative for me. We began our mission in Tel Aviv, a hustling and bustling city known for its liberal ethos, its beaches, its great restaurants, its incredible gay and queer culture, as well as a thriving art scene. We spent part of the day volunteering in a makeshift chamal, which is a Hebrew word for a resource center. We were packing boxes with necessities for the refugees around the country that were living in hotels or in other makeshift shelters. On our second day, we made our way south, stopping in two of the towns hit the hardest on October 7th. We visited the home of Rachel, a hero in Israel. Per ingenuity, when terrorists broke into her home, she delayed the inevitable death of those in the house by offering to feed the intruders, all the while she was secretly signaling to commandos, including her own son, who were outside of the house, telling them where the terrorists were, until she was finally liberated. And for her heroism, she's become quite a cause celeb in Israel. So we went to see her house. And as we stood in her house, a woman was standing next door named Ilana, and she saw our friend Mark, who was on the phone with Kyron, and said, "Come over, I want to tell you my story." And so we all stood around as a woman who didn't speak any English began to tell us her story of what she saw on that day on October 7th, as she watched as her neighbors were killed, as policemen hurried to the scene, were killed, how courageous other policemen came to take their bodies away, lest they be taken by the terrorists. And from that moment, we then made our way to the Nova Festival, where we walked around a modern-day Baba Yar, right in the south of Israel. Makeshift memorials and graves created for the some 347 young men and women who were mercilessly slaughtered, hiding in the trees that we drove by. The burned tires and the burned parts of the cars that were parked in the entrance still making an indelible imprint in the street beneath us. I remember vividly, as soon as I arrived, I was walking between these stakes that had been placed with pictures of those who had been at the festival. As I was weaving my way, I stopped at the sight of one lone guitar player crouched in front of a picture that looked incredibly similar to his own face, his brother. And he was in a trance playing the guitar, serenading his younger brother. Remarkable at the scene, there was a tent with a sofer with a scribe who was writing a Sefer Torah, writing a Torah scroll in honor of the souls that had been lost and offering anyone who wanted to be able to write a letter into that Torah. It's the holiest imaginable Torah you could possibly envision. And from the Nova Festival, we made our way to another chamal, another resource center, but this time for soldiers. Chamal was feeding 2,000 some odd soldiers a day. The soldiers were coming in for a hot meal, or just for some music, or just for, you know, some games, maybe some warm socks. And we happened to be talking to three amazing chayalot, amazing women soldiers, Shiran and Hodaya, and I think it was Evgenia, or it was Ilana. It was amazing. It was like someone from the Ukraine originally, and full of smiles and warmth. telling us how they were excited they were to be serving. And on our fourth day, we made our way back to Jerusalem. We met with a remarkable NGO that is feeding Jerusalemites and others from extra food left over at restaurants and so on, Matzidei Mazon. And then on Shabbat afternoon, maybe the most challenging part of the trip, we made our way to East Jerusalem to meet a theater group, an art center that puts on programs with Palestinians and Israelis to listen to their story, how they're dealing with the aftermath of October 7th. Each and every one of these experiences was absolutely memorable and imprinted on my soul. But you know, so much happens in Israel, not in the locations that everybody goes to, but on the way to those locations in cabs. Really, talking to cab drivers, not always the most illuminating experience for sure, but definitely in this turn was very powerful for me. I have a history with cab drivers in Israel. On my first trip there in 1982 for my bar mitzvah, my family had hired a cab driver whose name was Shem Tov. Shem Tov was like classic Israeli. Like somebody, you know, probably in his 40s, had a hard belly and a lot of opinions. And I was a young kid who was just so excited to be on my first trip to Israel. And Shem Tov and I bonded, and he bonded with my family. He invited us to his home. We had lunch in Shem Tov's home. I remember it vividly. So on my way to the airport this past Wednesday morning in Israel, my cab driver was named Uri. Uri is a 37-year-old Iraqi, descended Israeli. And Uri struck me as a very articulate and very astute observer of everything that had been going on. He told me about where he was on October 7th day, what he was thinking. And then he casually told me, this guy playing the radio, that he'd just been released from Gaza just a couple of days before. He had spent 3 months in Gaza, and he was now back in his regular life. But he said to me, I've already received orders to return to the army in May for what might be an even bigger war. Uri then told me that he has two young daughters. I asked him whether going back scared him, and he said, of course it does. Betach, betach. I have two young girls, he said. But who else will fight for us, he asked. Indeed, who else will fight for all of us? Everywhere you look in Israel, you see this will to sacrifice, this recognition of a bigger cause that one is a part of, and something else as well. That though in recent years things have changed a bit, ultimately, Israelis feel we are alone again. Heroism is at the heart of Israel. It's what brought thousands of Israelis from abroad back to Israel in the immediate aftermath of the October 7th pogrom. It's what thousands of Israelis are doing by returning to a second and third tour of duty, even after having been wounded, some of them. Stories abound of soldiers armed with only a handgun who fought off terrorists for hours, literally saving hundreds of lives. And not only that, Israelis who can't serve feel guilty. I got a haircut in Tel Aviv on Tuesday, and my barber, Yossi, was lamenting the fact that he had had cancer years before that disqualified him from being with his friends in Gaza now, fighting for Israel. The willingness to take up arms, to run into danger, to unhesitatingly serve, it wasn't limited to one demographic in the wake of the pogrom. It wasn't one political party or one religious ideology. Everyone was galvanized and mobilized. Everyone participated. Muslims, Christians, Arabs, Jews, everyone in the diverse, dynamic democracy that is in Israel, all of them wanted to help out. It's true that in the months preceding October 7th, Israeli society and world Jewry had been on the edge. Murmurings of civil war, of intra-tribal conflict were being discussed everywhere, even though the majority of Israel, 57%, was in favor of some kind of reform. The path taken by the government had clearly brought Israel to the brink. Perhaps not since the months preceding Yitzhak Rabin's assassination had I and many others experienced such an extreme war for the soul of the country. But October 7th changed everything. Perhaps like Rabin's assassination, we in Israel and here experienced a near-death experience. Dr. Micha Goodman, great intellectual in Israel, has framed it that way. Micha explained that the first generation of Israelis knew what it was like to not have an Israel. But every successive generation became more and more used to the fact of Israel's existence, until the nation watched helplessly as Israel, as it had understood itself, ceased to exist for a day. In Micha's words, October 7th, there was no Israel. Israel was not there. And then he said, Israelis now see themselves as the new founders of the new Israel. They can imagine a reality that only the earliest founders could, namely a world without a Jewish army, without a Jewish power. And they will never take that for granted again. At the core of what motivates parent after parent to send their child to the IDF is a recognition that what stands between Israel and daily October 7th are the brave men and women who protect Israel from her enemies. If anything, that depressing reality became crystal clear on that horrible Black Sabbath morning, when instead of dancing with the Torah, Israelis grabbed whatever they could and ran to save friends, family, and even strangers from hell. But if 10-7 clarified for Israelis who the true enemy is, for many of us who find ourselves in liberal Jewish spaces here and elsewhere in the diaspora, public hand-wringing has dominated the discourse. The privileged Jewish community wrings its hand as it tries to make its way through what it considers a moral minefield. In the immediate aftermath of the atrocities, when the world still seemed to have clear bad guys and good guys, even in the haze of shock and disbelief, one thing seemed entirely certain. Hamas equals evil, and Israelis equal victims. But that moral arithmetic that allowed good liberals like me and so many others to distinguish between terrorism and an army built to protect against terrorists has disappeared and vanished. Shocked and disillusioned, we on the left expressed our deep disappointment, our deep disenfranchisement, our loneliness and hurt. Allies, we said, had abandoned us in a despicable way. Never would we have imagined this could happen, we said. But very few of us, if any, did our own cheshbon ha-nefesh, internal accounting. Very few, if any, publicly acknowledged ways that we liberals were complicit in the eventual betrayal of the left. Very few, if any, publicly admitted that the rot and decay in the center of the worldview that we have championed led academics and otherwise enlightened folk to celebrate the murder of Jewish children. What's worse is that even now, with 134 people still being held by inhumane terrorists, we have Jewish leaders saying absurd things like, we must demand Israel conduct itself according to Jewish values. Demand that Israel conduct itself according to Jewish values. Anyone who has ever spent a minute with an Israeli soldier or spent a minute in Israel knows how absurd that hypocritical statement is from Senator Chuck Schumer. Anyone who spent 5 minutes discussing with a general or anyone else in Israel what it is that they are contending with at this moment, the moral ambiguities and the frustrating nuancing of what it is to fight a war against terrorists who have embedded themselves cynically amongst their own population, and the lengths that Israel goes to try its best under absurd circumstances to rid themselves of a cancer that is on its southern border. No, not to speak, of course, of what's going on in the north. Anyone who knows that for 5 minutes can feel how insulting it is, how condescending it is to people who live in Israel, who send their children to the army. I have friends and family in Israel. Are their children genocidal maniacs? This ideology is so all-pervasive and so insidious and so dangerous. Even rabbinic scholars and rabbinic leaders in our communities have bought into it. The language of genocide, the language of ethnic cleansing. A dear, dear rabbinic friend, someone I love dearly, who sends out missives that I just can't read because they hurt me so much, but I read them just to know what he's thinking. He wrote this today that I received in an email. Most Jews of the world will use the mass of the holiday, this coming Purim tomorrow night, to cover over their moral failures and their cowardice to stand up to the forces of Haman when they arose from within our own ranks. What? What? All we needed to know about the current pathology in the West visited us on those fateful days in October. We should all be extremely suspicious of the West's moral calculations in this regard. What became obvious to many of us in the aftermath of October 7th is this. Israel's survival is an existential requirement for the Jewish people. And therefore, although Israeli soldiers heroically fight our enemies far away, they are also fighting for us right here on the Upper West Side. When we visited the South, we stopped off to get some food at the home of a woman named Aussie. Aussie, 54-year-old, mother of three boys, who loves to cook delicious Moroccan food. We got together in her home. Her hospitality was monumental. And she came to speak with us and tell us about what life was like for her during that fateful day. And told us that one of her children had just come back from Gaza. And then she said something remarkable to the group. She said, "I don't know what you guys are doing here. I mean, I'm thankful, but I'm really, really sure, like, I don't get it." So I said to her, "Aussie, allow me, if I may, to tell you that I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I'm a privileged Jew in America. And I also have three boys like you. And if I were living here, my three boys would be defending the Jewish people, putting their lives at risk, just like yours. I don't know what it's like for you and for all of our Israeli brothers and sisters to be okay with the knowing that in 3 months, they'll be back on the front lines again with two daughters at home, wondering if they're going to come home. So the least I can do as an American Jew is to show up in Israel. The least I could do as an American Jew is show up and show support. So thank you for feeding us with your delicious Moroccan food. But we owe you a debt of gratitude that we will never be able to repay. Israel has become the new excuse for hating Jews. The war in Gaza is not ethnic cleansing, and it's not genocide. It isn't a clandestine land grab by the ultra-Orthodox members of the ruling government. The three young Israeli soldiers we met stationed on the Gaza border are not a part of a state-sponsored terrorist organization called the IDF, but they are heroic soldiers in an army whose purpose is to protect the inhabitants of Israel, Jew, non-Jew, Palestinian, Arab, Bedouins, all of those who live within its borders, from enemies whose sworn purpose is to cause Israeli inhabitants harm. It is extremely alarming to me to hear fellow Jews claiming this is Bibi's fault, agreeing with the esteemed Senator Chuck Schumer in his ludicrous assertion that Bibi and his government are somehow to blame for this war. If we put aside the obvious strategic blunder here, Schumer only serves to embolden Netanyahu and his base with his interference. There's a larger issue with Schumer's stance. Schumer does not speak for me or for most Israelis for that matter. Many, if not most Israelis, no longer trust Bibi, that's true. But that isn't because they feel the operation in Gaza is not just. Most, if not all, believe that it is. All of this has me thinking about Purim and this weekend. One of the core features of Purim are the two words that I used that we were singing as we started the sermon tonight. Venafochu, reverse it, turn it over. Just when you think things are going well, things go badly in the Megillah, and just when you think things are going terribly, they somehow turn out to be great. Purim is the story of reversals. There's no greater reversal in Jewish history than the reversal that the rabbis add to the story of Purim. The rabbis in the Talmud say that one is to drink on Purim until you can't distinguish between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. For many years, I thought that that wonderful, unique feature of our Mardi Gras day was to tell us to get stoned, to get lit, to have a good time, or more mystically minded, to ascend to the level of non-duality, where all things collapse. Like Rumi said, there is a field out there beyond good and evil. I will meet you there. Purim somehow became the most mystical of all of our holidays. And now I kind of read this invitation to a blurring of these distinctions in a somewhat more nefarious way. You want to know what a world is like when you can't tell the difference between Haman and Mordechai? That's a crazy world. One day we'll give you a taste. Drink a little bit so that you are so distorted that you confuse yourself between Haman and Mordechai. But that's not the way we're to live our lives 364 days of the year. Being able to distinguish between Haman and Mordechai is a crucial, crucial moral and ethical capacity. We Jews have everything to be proud of this Purim. We are in mourning, a people deeply traumatized. And we are conducting ourselves remarkably well under those circumstances, under the circumstances of a situation that we did not ask for, but that we have no right but to finish. Anyone who knows me for more than 5 minutes knows how much it hurts me, how much it pains me to think that the only way forward is to think in these terms. I lived the last 20 years of my life hoping and praying that the way that we would bring peace to the world was by meditating, by singing, by listening, by empathy, by arts, by all of the methodologies of the left. If only I understood the Palestinian narrative. So I went to Israel on encounter and I met with Palestinians, and I did. And this time too, we met with Palestinians. And I deeply believe in understanding the path of the other and where they come from. It's part of who I am as a human being. To not rob the other person of their own narrative, their own subjectivity, their own perspective. But something is wrong in our worldview. And we should take a moment to think about whether or not it is actually true that doubling down on what didn't work will work going forward. Israelis thinking to themselves, wondering how they are to rejoice on Purim this year, come to the rabbis and others and have asked them questions like I've received too, which is, how do we do it this year? How do we make merry after the last 5.5 months? And I received a prayer that moved me deeply. It was penned by the daughter of the late great Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. And it played on the Kol Nidre prayer. There's a tradition that Purim and Yom Kippur are connected somehow. There's like, you can hear it, right? Purim, Kippurim, Kippurim, Kippur. So using Kol Nidre, the release of vows, she wrote a beautiful prayer. And it essentially goes like this. Al data makom, al data kal, by the permission of God and the permission of this community. I come before you to ask permission this year to get a heter, to be released, to have joy, and to dance. In the name of all of those who fell, in the name of all of those who have been taken hostage, in the name of all of those who have served, we come before you this year and ask you to give us a release, to dance together, to feel unity together, to tell tales of a time when reversals meant that we were saved from almost certain death and genocide, to survive, to tell the story. I stand here today to tell you, as long as I'm a rabbi in this community, in any community, I will never, ever say anything from this pulpit that won't go through this filter in my heart. If a soldier of Israel, a heroic man or woman who carried a gun for the sake of the protection of my children here and everywhere there are Jews, were standing here in my synagogue and I said something, would they be offended? Would they be offended? And I challenge rabbis in the liberal Jewish world and beyond it, and politicians, to open their mouths only with that permission, the permission of those brothers and sisters whose lives are on the line, to my cab driver friend Uri, who is not a cab driver but a gibor, a hero, and a prayer that with his permission and with the permission of all others, that this Purim, tomorrow night, we dance and sing, we make merry, we remember one day a year we're permitted to forget who's Haman and who's Mordechai, and then we get back to work, making this planet a safe place for our people, and eventually a safe place for all people. May God bless us and bless the state of Israel and all of its heroic, heroic soldiers.
Thank you for listening. Want more content like this? Subscribe to our podcast and visit romamu.org to learn more about us. Please consider making a contribution to Romamu so we can continue to fulfill our mission to help spiritual seekers deepen their connection to Jewish wisdom and practice to help them become more compassionate human beings. We hope to see you in the synagogue or the Zoomagogue soon. Romamu, Romamu, Adonai.